So I'd like to welcome everyone back to this last session within this Shamatha practice program, focusing on mindfulness of breathing. So as we've been doing in each session, we can begin with setting a good motivation for the session. And we can each do that in our own way. So let's have a look at what we'll be covering in the session this evening, titled Integrating into Daily Life. We'll start with a summary of some of the main points that we covered in this program. And then the first meditation will be mindfulness of breathing. And this time you choose which variation you prefer to do. Then we'll look at the what sort of supporting framework is going to be very helpful for this shamatha practice and effective for shamatha practice. Some general advice, followed up by how to set up the day based on the shamatha practice. And then the meditation to help us to reflect on how to make our life meaningful. We'll look at, do a meditation called Building a Vision for This Life. Time for question answer, and then we'll finish with a dedication. In this program, in these eight sessions, we first began with an introduction, and then we had two sessions focusing on the mindfulness of breathing with the full body practice, including how to meditate with Shavasana posture, very good for relaxation, followed by two sessions focusing on the abdomen, and then two sessions focusing at the entrance of the nostrils. And again, the recommended reading for this program was Attention Revolution from Alan Wallace, and a very good book on shamatha. And if you like a little bit more in-depth technical information, then you can look at the Lamrim Chenmo, The Great Treatise on Stages of Path to Enlightenment from Lama Tsongkhapa in Volume 3. There's a lot of very good information there about a lot of these points we covered in this program. So remember again, what was shamatha? Shamatha was a Sanskrit term. Shama means calm, ta means to remain or abide, so often translated into English as calm abiding, meaning not only a calm mind, but a mind that is abiding single-pointedly on an object. So shamatha is the practice of cultivating a calm, clear, and focused mind. So therefore, in other words, it's a concentration, or in Sanskrit, samadhi practice, developing single-pointed concentration. And shamatha is the level of concentration that we are cultivating here. Why is this practice important? We saw that in terms of everyday life, this practice is helping us to improve our attention skills, which means that we'll be much more effective in everything we do in our life, much less agitation and stress, so therefore much better mental balance. It will really help us to become the masters of our mind instead of being the slaves of our mind. And then often some health benefits as well in terms of better sleep and so forth. But here, the main reason we're engaging in this practice is in terms of the pursuit of genuine happiness. We saw there that in all Buddhist traditions, in terms of the pursuit of genuine happiness, they're all covering the same three core areas of practice of ethics, concentration, and wisdom. And we saw here in the Mahayana Buddhist traditions, which the Tibetan Buddhism is part of, is that the Vipassana practice, the wisdom practice that we need to engage in to achieve this genuine happiness, is this wisdom realizing emptiness, realizing that nothing exists independently. In order to directly realize that, we need a very stable and clear mind. And so hence, we saw this quote here from that chart, shamatha chart: the root of samsara is cut by the union of shamatha and vipassana observing emptiness. Therefore, in order for us to overcome our distorted view of reality and thereby overcome our mental afflictions and suffering and achieve genuine happiness, then we need that direct realization of emptiness. To have that, we need shamatha. So therefore, shamatha is really key in terms of achieving that genuine happiness. And in the practice, in the shamatha meditation, in fact, in all meditations, we need to prepare ourselves well at the beginning of a practice, any meditation, preparing body, speech, and mind. We saw there in terms of body, setting up a good posture. The two most important things is to keep the back straight, or in other words, a vigilant posture, and allow the entire body to become completely relaxed. And then allowing the body to remain as still as possible, avoiding any unnecessary movement during meditation. And then also to simply allow the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. And by doing this, this will help to settle the mind. So this will be a segue into preparing the mind. And in terms of preparing the mind, also like the body, to allow the mind to settle in a state of relaxation into the stillness of the present moment and remaining vividly clear. And if we prepare ourselves well at the beginning of every meditation session, then the meditation, actual meditation, will go a lot better. We need to spend as much time as we need to do this preparation. If we don't do it or cut it short, then we're just going to have more problems in the actual meditation session. And here in this shamatha practice, we saw that there are three qualities to cultivate. In the original meditation texts, generally two are mentioned: stability and clarity. Stable mind means to be able to focus without becoming distracted, and to clarity, to focus on the object in a very clear way, overcoming dullness. However, we added that third quality of relaxation that you often won't see in the old original texts. That's something that is very important for us in the modern world, because many of us come into meditation practice with very chaotic minds, with a lot of agitation and stress and tension. And our habit when we focus is to tense. And so if we bring this into meditation practice, a lot of tension, we're going to have all sorts of problems in meditation. So the very first thing we need to do is to learn to relax the body and the mind. And then on the basis of relaxation, then we can really cultivate better stability, stronger stability, then we can cultivate better clarity, using that tree analogy, that each one builds on the next, is the basis for the next quality. In terms of objects, we use the object that works best for us. And very often in the meditation texts, and we see here a quote from the Lamrim Chenmo from Tsongkhapa, who says, if you have a predominance of discursiveness, meaning a lot of thoughts going on in the mind constantly, then definitely you have to meditate on the breath. So this accounts for most of us in the modern world. We tend to be caught up in a lot of obsessive compulsive thinking. So for many of us in the modern world, the best object to use is the breath. And this is why we use the breath in this program. And in this program, we use three variations of this breath practice: the full body practice, the full body breath awareness, very good for relaxation, focusing on the abdomen, very good for improving stability of attention. And then in the last two sessions, focusing at the entrance of the nostrils, very good for improving clarity of attention. And then we also earlier mentioned a number of other objects that we can use. Two objects that are very much recommended in attention revolution: one is to observe the mind, and the other one is resting in awareness. Very much suited for us in the modern world, because they really can help us to become the masters of our mind instead of being the slaves of our own mind. And then we saw in the Lamrim Chenmo that very much emphasized the object of focusing on a mental image of a Buddha. And this is very good preparation for the higher level of Tantra practice. Many people, however, find that quite challenging because it's a complex visualization. And then we even saw that we can even use a visual object to get into the practice. But a visual object, any sort of sense object, a visual object or sound, is quite coarse, and it can't take us very far in the practice. And then if we started with one of those objects, we would then have to move to a more subtle object, such as the breath or an image or the mind or so forth, to go further into the practice. But again, the bottom line with object is to use the object that works best for you. Tools, what tools we use for the practice. We saw there the two main tools, the symbolism of the rope of mindfulness, meaning to tie our mind with a rope of mindfulness to the object. So mindfulness is simply our ability to hold the object, to remember the object, to not forget it, to not become distracted. And the second tool was the hook of introspection, introspection being quality control, to monitor the mindfulness, to notice if we are succumbing to dullness or distraction. So that's quality control. So we need to use these two tools in this shamatha practice. And then we saw there are five main faults that can arise in this practice. The first one is laziness. And to overcome laziness in terms of doing the practice, to first cultivate faith, by reflecting on the benefits of the practice, to appreciate that this practice is going to bring us enormous benefits and thereby have faith in the practice. And that will lead to aspiration to do the practice. The more aspiration we have to do the practice, the more enthusiasm and effort we'll put into practice. And then slowly we'll achieve more and more physical pliancy, physical and mental pliancy, serviceability and flexibility of body and mind. Forgetfulness, the second fault, forgetting the instructions, forgetting the object. The antidote, mindfulness, to remember the instructions, to remember the object. And the two main imbalances of laxity and excitation, the technical terms for dullness and distraction. Again, that's the job of introspection, quality control, to monitor, to notice that. And then non-application was when we notice we've become dull or distracted and we don't do anything about it. So the antidote is application, which often will simply mean to reapply mindfulness to the object. And then over-application is at the higher levels of practice when we are actually focusing well on the object, but we're unnecessarily adjusting the focus. So there the antidote is equanimity, meaning balance, to simply leave the mind as it is because it's already balanced, it's already focusing well on the object. And if we apply those eight antidotes to those five faults, then we move along these nine stages to shamatha. So we saw in earlier sessions there that this is the classic model that's often used to describe the stages of progress in this shamatha practice, particularly when we're using an object such as the breath. And we saw also that this is accomplished through these six powers and four mental engagements, that these six powers are really helping us to move on to the higher and higher levels of the path to shamatha. First, the power of hearing, to hear about the practice, to listen to instructions so we know what to do. Then that can help us to start the practice, to get to stage one. And then if we think and reflect about the practice, to understand it better, to get more enthusiastic about the practice, that can help us to get to stage two. And then if we're strengthening our mindfulness, that can help us to go further onto stages three and four. And then fine-tuning that focus more with introspection helps us to get up to through stages five and six. And then more and more enthusiasm in the practice is what propels us onto stages seven and eight, and then complete familiarity, which is what enables us to get to stage nine. And then eventually getting to the goal of shamatha. And so let's now go to the meditation. And so we'll do mindfulness of breathing because that's what's been our object for this program. We have looked at three variations, the full body breath practice, noticing sensations of the breath anywhere in the body. Together with that or related to that, a slight variation of that is to simply notice the rhythm of the breath, then focusing at the abdomen and the nostrils. So for this meditation, you choose. You can choose whichever of those variations you prefer. In all of those, we're using bare attention, observing tactile sensations directly, and maintaining a continuity of mindfulness throughout the entire cycle of each breath. And don't forget the balance. So as we're enhancing stability and clarity, to not lose that relaxation. So always using introspection to monitor the state of your body and mind. Am I still relaxed in the body and the mind, or am I tensing? And if there's any tension arising in body or mind, to release it, particularly on the out-breath. And then for those two imbalances of laxity and excitation, we had those key words that we introduced earlier to help remind us what to do. And if you find yourself getting constantly distracted from the breath, then if you find it helpful, you can introduce a bit of counting or noting of the breath to help stabilize your attention. And if you're finding that you're getting a lot of tension building up in the body and the mind and you can't release it, then, and that probably will happen if you're focusing at the nostrils, because it's harder to focus, bringing the attention up. So at any time, if you find that tension building up and you can't release it, then shift back out of the nostrils, back down to the full body or the abdomen, and really emphasizing that relaxation. So that's what we're going to do in the meditation now. And since these practices are very familiar, I'll do very little guiding, maybe just a little bit of guiding to prepare. And then during the actual meditation session, I'll remain silent to give you an opportunity to go a little bit deeper into the practice. So if you'd like to find a nice, comfortable posture, let's begin the meditation. We begin, as always, by preparing the body, setting the body into a state of relaxation, stillness, and vigilance. And using the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. And softening and relaxing all the muscles in the face. All the muscles around the eyes, soft and relaxed. And allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Simply allowing it to flow naturally and effortlessly. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen, happily releasing them. And simply allowing the mind to come to rest. To rest in the stillness of the present moment. the mind relaxed, still, and clear. And then from that stillness, shift your attention to the variation of mindfulness of breathing that you want to follow in this meditation. Either the full body, the rhythm, the abdomen, or entrance of the nostrils. And maintaining an ongoing flow of mindfulness. We can bring the meditation to a close. The first topic I'd like to look at is supporting framework. What sort of framework are we bringing to this shamatha practice? And so here we can talk about worldview in terms of two sort of categories. One, first is the worldview which sees the source of happiness and suffering is out there in the world. In other words, it's all about what happens to us, whether we're going to have happiness or suffering. And so with this worldview, which is dominant in the modern world, then because the source of suffering and happiness seems to be out there, then we tend to equate pleasure with happiness and pain with suffering. And so with this worldview, then it's all about what we can get from the world, that we try and get as much pleasure and try and avoid as much pain as possible. But of course, we're always faced with unpleasant, painful situations. And so therefore, with this worldview, the world appears as not very user-friendly because there's a lot of unpleasant things coming at us. And then in terms of doing, with this worldview, doing shamatha practice, then I think there's going to be a lot of laziness because we're so caught up in trying to manipulate the world around us, trying to putting a lot of time and energy in trying to get those pleasant things that seem to be the source of our happiness, and putting a lot of time and energy trying to avoid those unpleasant things out there that really seem to be the source of our suffering. And so we're simply not going to have any time to meditate. And then if we actually engage in shamatha practice with this worldview, then as we saw, I think in yesterday's session, from Attention Revolution, when we talked about these prerequisites, that if we have this approach, then as Alan Wallace said, it's like a Band-Aid applied to a festering wound. And unfortunately, that's sort of a little bit the approach in some modern mindfulness traditions. Is mindfulness is very, very useful, but often it's given without any effective framework. It's usually given just simply on the basis of what people already believe, that this worldview, that the source of happiness and suffering is out there. And so then we, based on that, we have a lot of craving and attachment to pleasant things, a lot of aversion, hostility, anger, hatred to difficult things, unpleasant, difficult people and so forth. And therefore we end up reacting a lot and have quite a sort of a dysfunctional lifestyle. And on that basis, we just simply add mindfulness to that. And that's a little bit like, as Alan Wallace said, like putting a Band-Aid on a festering wound. It doesn't really, it's not very effective. And someone here some years ago coined this term for this approach to mindfulness, McMindfulness, as in McDonald's. It's the fast food of mindfulness. It's unhealthy type of mindfulness because it's not addressing any of these dysfunctional tendencies and our dysfunctional worldview, rather than just trying to put a little bit of mindfulness on top of that, like putting the Band-Aid on the festering wound. And I think it's not going to be very effective. And also it could actually make things worse, because if we just simply add a little bit of mindfulness to a dysfunctional lifestyle, we just might get more focused at being able to cheat people and deceive people and so forth. And then we're just going to attract more and more problems. So in fact, because of this approach a little bit, I recently read an article from a person, and the title was something like "The Dark Side of Mindfulness." Basically, the author was saying that, you know, mindfulness is not all it's cracked out to be. There's a dark side. In fact, it can create a lot of problems for us. There's no dark side to mindfulness. There's only a dark side to using mindfulness without an effective framework, a helping, supporting framework. And so then we can get into trouble. Whereas if we have an effective supporting framework, one where we have this worldview that the source of happiness and suffering is not out there anywhere, it lies within our own mind, then it's not so much about what happens to us, but how we respond to what happens to us. And so in this worldview, we don't equate pleasure with happiness and pain with suffering. Whether or not we suffer will depend on how we react or respond to pleasant and unpleasant things that come our way. And so then it's not so much about what we can get from the world, but rather what we can bring to the world. And with this worldview, then the world appears much more user-friendly. And with this worldview, then instead of being very lazy when it comes to doing the shamatha practice, we'll be very enthusiastic to meditate, to do the shamatha practice, because we'll realize that by doing the shamatha practice, this is the gateway to genuine happiness. And so we'll put a lot of time and energy into shamatha practice. And so if we can shift our worldview to this worldview, that the source of genuine happiness and well-being is coming from within our own mind, and shamatha is the key that opens that gate, then that's going to be very effective, helpful in doing the shamatha practice. How do we cultivate this view of genuine happiness? What we see here in many Buddhist traditions, certainly in all the Tibetan Buddhist traditions, is the first step is to reflect on precious human life and death. Because we don't tend to appreciate the opportunity we have now. That often we only appreciate things either when we've lost them or about to lose them. And so even though we have a life full of opportunities to make it meaningful, we tend to waste it because we don't appreciate it. And so therefore, by reflecting on precious human life and death, understanding that this precious opportunity is not going to last forever, that will help us to have an aspiration to make our life meaningful and to make it meaningful now. And then on that basis, to next reflection is to reflect on the causality of our actions, that if we engage in harmful behavior, we'll end up with suffering results. If we engage in virtuous behavior, we'll have happiness results. And then on that basis of that reflection, that would inspire us to adopt an ethical lifestyle. So this would be the foundation of any meaningful life, is to adopt an ethical lifestyle. And then in addition to that, then to really reflect on suffering and its causes. What is suffering and what's its causes of suffering? Where does suffering originate from? And this is really the first two noble truths. And then through this reflection, to really understand that suffering is coming from within our own mind, that the real underlying source of our suffering is, at the deepest level, our distorted view of reality, this grasping onto an independent me and an independent world. And then through that, we end up with having craving and attachment to pleasant things, aversion to unpleasant things, and then the whole mess starts from there. And that's driving our behavior and resulting in our suffering. And so if we can appreciate that, and at the same time then appreciate this distorted view of reality is something that we can eliminate by coming to realize the nature of reality through Vipassana practice, then we can really shift our worldview, that the source of happiness and the source of suffering is not out there, lies within our own mind. And those of you who have studied the Lam Rim know these reflections very well. These are some of the very first reflections that come in the Lam Rim, the precious human life, and then reflecting on these other points in terms of the person of lower initial capacity and even middling capacity. However, in other Tibetan Buddhist traditions, in the Kagyu and Nyingma, they package these four reflections in a single package, and they're often called the four thoughts. The four thoughts that turn the mind in terms of shifting our perspective, our worldview. And so here we have these four reflections coming from one of these practices from the, this in fact is coming from the Dzogchen tradition in the Nyingma school. These are exactly the same reflections you see in Ma Mudra and in Lam Rim and so forth. And the first one is this life of leisure and opportunity is extremely difficult to find, to reflect on this precious human life. The second one, the measure of birth is impermanence and death. The results of third one, the results of virtuous and harmful actions are infallible. And the fourth reflection is that the three realms of samsara are just an ocean of suffering. And so by doing these reflections and internalizing them and remembering them, then we will be inspired to transform our mind into Dharma, to turn our mind, to shift that worldview and to engage in a more meaningful life and thereby the gateway to that genuine happiness is this shamatha practice on the basis of ethics. And so if we really cultivate this view of genuine happiness, then we're going to be much more easily able to implement these prerequisites for shamatha we saw in the previous session, that we'll be able to have few material desires and be much more content because we'll see those things that we're chasing after out there are never going to satisfy us. And so we'll be content with adequate material possessions. And then we'll be able to have few activities to simplify our life because we'll lose interest in all these things we chase after in our life. And also therefore to adopt an ethical lifestyle, have ethical discipline and help. And that will also enable us to more easily let go of compulsive thinking. Because a lot of our obsessive compulsive thinking is about thinking about all the, how we can get those things that out there that seem to give us happiness and how we can avoid those things out there that seem to give us a lot of suffering. So we'll be able to let go a lot of those. So therefore, from this view of genuine happiness, having this as a supporting framework, we'll be able to establish these prerequisites for shamatha practice more easily, much more easily. And as I just mentioned, we're going to have much more enthusiasm to meditate. And here again, quoting from Attention and Evolution, mental balance is the gateway to finding genuine happiness and shamatha is the key that opens that gate. And also by shifting this worldview, this will enable our career to be much more fulfilling and rewarding because then it's all about what I can bring from the world rather than what I can get from the world. If we have the worldview, the source of happiness and suffering is out there somewhere, then I think no matter what career we have, no matter how high a position we have, no matter how much money we're earning and so forth, I think in the end, our career will not really be very rewarding, fulfilling and satisfying. We'll never be satisfied because we'll never be able to get enough, no matter how high a position we have, no matter how much money, no matter how big a house and so forth, we will never be satisfied. In fact, we'll probably at some point realize it's never going to satisfy us and we'll maybe end up with a lot of depression instead. Rather that if we shift the worldview, then even if our career is just an average sort of job, it can be much more rewarding because it's all about what we can bring to the world. Then we can use whatever talents we have to help people around us. And then it can be very rewarding. Even a very simple job can be very rewarding. And then also with this shifting worldview, we'll be able to, as I mentioned before, with the worldview, the source of happiness and suffering's out there, then the world won't seem very user-friendly. With the shifting the worldview, the source of happiness and suffering is within, then the world will be very much more user-friendly. And therefore, we'll be able to make this shift that when we're faced with difficult situations in our life, now often when we're faced with difficulties in our life, because they seem to be problems then, because we don't want them, because they seem to be the source of our suffering, then we develop aversion, and then we actually end up with a lot of suffering because it's our aversion to difficulties that really causes the suffering. So if we shift the worldview, then we'll be able to much more easily see difficult situations, not as problems or obstacles, but as actually as opportunities. Because then they challenge us. If we really look at our life at when we most developed as a person, generally it's not when things are going well in our life. When things are going well in our life, we just sort of drift along and not really develop as a person. It's only when we face difficulties and are challenged that we really develop as a person. So these difficult situations very much are opportunities, opportunities to develop ourselves, to bring more to the world. So if we shift the worldview, we can take advantage of these difficult situations rather than just having aversion and suffering more. Now, some general advice. First, when to meditate. And of course, daily meditation practice, continuity is a key to progress. And generally, the recommendation is to meditate early in the morning, first thing in the morning, because that's when we're most fresh, where it's most quiet, and a good way to start the day. Very much recommended to meditate at the same time every day, because if we keep changing the time when we meditate, then we're not developing a habit. And one of the most difficult things initially for meditation is simply developing the habit. And if we keep changing when we meditate, we're not really developing a habit. So pick a time that works for you and stick to that time. And then after some days, it will start to become a habit and it'll become easier. And in terms of helping to develop a habit, set yourself challenges when you're starting. So set yourself, for example, a 7-day challenge. For the next 7 days, I'm going to meditate at this time every day. And once you've done that a few times, then you can say, okay, for the next 30 days, I'm going to meditate at this time every day. And then once we've done that, we'll start to develop a habit, and then it'll become easier to meditate each morning. Where to meditate? As we saw in the prerequisites, one of the prerequisites was to meditate in a quiet location, because one of the biggest causes of distraction is noise. If you can't find a quiet place, as I think mentioned earlier, very helpful to have noise cancelling headphones. Very, very helpful. Also, it's good, if possible, to have a separate room to meditate in, if you have that luxury and use that as a meditation room. If you don't have that, set aside a corner of a room for meditation and make where you meditate inviting and comfortable. Because if you go into that space, then you associate that with meditation. Whereas if you simply meditate on your bed, generally you associate bed with sleep, so you probably find yourself very drowsy if you meditate on your bed. So make up a space for meditation, make it inviting and comfortable, and then every time you go there, you'll have this mental association. It's a meditation time now. And then also to adjust the lighting and temperature to suit, to help, again, avoid the likelihood of laxity or excitation. How long to meditate? We saw in the earlier session also to really, particularly Lama Tsongkhapa we were quoting, to emphasize quality over quantity. Because particularly as a beginner, if we try and meditate too long, then we're not going to be able to sustain that. And in the latter part of the meditation, we're just going to fall into complete dullness and complete distraction. And then we're simply increasing the very faults that we're trying to decrease. And we saw there the advantages of using a meditation timer in terms of helping to develop perseverance and enthusiasm. And we need, though, once we start to get into the practice, we need to slowly increase the duration of the session. Because if we only ever meditate 15 or 20 minutes in the morning, then we can only really get so far in the practice, in particular here talking shamatha practice. So therefore, we'll need at some point to start to increase the duration of your meditation session. How do we know it's the right time to increase how long we meditate? One measure is that if our normal experience is that at the end of the meditation, our normal experience is, oh, I would have liked to have done a little bit more, that's a good sign that it's time to increase. But don't double from 20 to 40 minutes, 3 to 5 minute increments. But always emphasizing quality over quantity. One more bit of general advice, and that is in terms of making effort. Now, we need to make effort in anything if we want to progress. So certainly in training the mind, we need effort. But remember here, effort, in fact, effort in Buddhism is defined as a mind that delights in virtue, means a mind that's happy to do good things. So if we're happy to do, something, then it really becomes effortless. So therefore, it's very important when we're applying effort in practice to maintain a joyful mind. Don't turn meditation practice into some sort of hardship that we have to endure. If we do, we've completely missed the point. We have that joyful state of mind. And the key to progress is continuity. So therefore, it's important to train the mind on a daily basis, i.e. a daily meditation practice, and then also to continue to integrate that into the rest of the day. And we'll look at how to do that shortly. In addition to that, very helpful to do an annual meditation retreat. And as a beginner, I very much recommend doing group retreat as opposed to solitary retreat. Much easier. It's there's structure, it's guided, and you have the group energy. And by doing a annual group retreat, say a week or 10 days, it can really give us a boost into our practice, and we can get a lot of inspiration from that as well. So maybe in terms of your annual holidays, instead of spending 2 weeks on the beach, you can spend 1 week on the beach and 1 week doing a meditation retreat. In terms of making effort to avoid unrealistic expectations, one expectation that simply gathering intellectual knowledge will change my life. So simply by going to a lot of teachings, getting a lot of intellectual knowledge about shamatha practice and other Buddhist concepts, that in itself will not change your life, because our behavior is not driven by our intellectual understanding. Our behavior is driven by our instinctive habits. And so therefore, in order to transform our life, we need to bring that intellectual knowledge into experience through meditation and integrating into daily life. And another expectation to avoid is that my practice will get better every week. You know, often people have this expectation that my practice should go like this, that every week, a little bit better, linear improvement. I don't know anyone whose practice goes like that. In the short term, there's a lot of up and down. So if we have these sorts of expectations, we're just going to set ourselves up for a lot of unnecessary frustration. So rather drop all expectations, have a long-term perspective, and then in the short term, there'll be a lot of variation. And again, it's not so much what happens to us that's important, but how we respond to what happens to us that's important. And again, when we're facing difficult situations, then to see them as opportunities, not to see them as problems or obstacles. And also, we mentioned earlier in the prerequisites, the importance of like-minded friends when we're making effort here in the spiritual path, that if we have this idea, I'm an independent person, I can do it myself, I think you're going to find it extremely difficult, if not impossible. Based on my own experience talking to many, many people, as a beginner, trying to do all of this on your own, very, very difficult, if not impossible, because we've got strong habits, we're easily influenced by others, and we'll just get swept up in our old habits. We're like swimming against the stream of the river. So we need help. So find these like-minded people, this spiritual community, Sangha, and support each other, and then we can make some progress. So next, setting up the day. How to set up our day based on the shamatha practice. First thing in the morning, very helpful to set a good motivation for the day. And here I have a motivation that I think is very good from His Holiness Dalai Lama, where he says, every day, think as you wake up, I'm going to benefit others as much as I can. I think if we can set this motivation in every morning, this will set ourselves up for the day very well. Again, in the morning, start with a meditation, pick a time, stick to it, quality over quantity, as we mentioned. And here in terms of shamatha practice in this program, we looked at mindfulness of breathing, these variations, full body, rhythm, abdomen, nostrils. So using whichever of those variations you find most effective. However, not to just do shamatha practice, that's a little bit imbalanced. We need a balanced approach to practice. And the other two main areas of practice are the two main wings of practice of wisdom and compassion. And so therefore also to integrate into your morning meditation some wisdom and some compassion, or vipassana and compassion practices. So we need a balance between those practices to be effective. And then and then during the day, if we want that shamatha practice to be effective, then we need to continue to cultivate mindfulness throughout the day. We could at the start of a day simply say, I'm going to be mindful for the whole day. We'll probably forget that after 5 minutes. So therefore, as a beginner, to help us to remind to be mindful, to use triggers. Triggers can take a number of forms. One is whenever we notice any tension in the body or the mind during the day, just stop whatever we're doing and then do a little mindfulness exercise. Maybe just focusing on your breathing for 3 breaths. Or when you're doing certain actions every day, make a strong determination to be fully present with that. For example, brushing teeth, eating meals, and so forth. And then also we can have apps, mindfulness apps to program that give us a little bell maybe once an hour. And when we hear that, to stop whatever we're doing, and little mindfulness exercise. Again, maybe just focusing on our breathing for 3 breaths. So if we seed the day with these moments of mindfulness, then we'll start to get in the habit of being more and more mindful through the day. Another thing very helpful, letting go of this compulsive thinking. Again, shifting worldview can be very helpful there, but also in terms of daily life, to anchor ourselves a little bit in the breath. Or also, whenever we're doing any physical activity, to be completely in the senses. If we're walking down the street, eating a meal or whatever physical activity we're doing, switch off that obsessive compulsive thinking mind and be fully present in the senses when we're doing that activity. And then at the end of the day, very helpful, before you go to bed, review the day. How did I go today? And then pick one good thing we did during the day. Rejoice in that, be very happy about that, and make a strong determination to continue that positive behavior the following day. Pick one negative thing we did during the day and have sincere regret for having done that negative thing, and make a strong determination not to do that negative thing the following day. In that way, we can both increase positive habits and decrease negative habits. And in addition, I think, because as I mentioned earlier, we tend to take things for granted. We don't appreciate how much we receive from others particularly, and from the world around us, is to think about one thing we receive during the day and have a sense of gratitude for that. And that can really transform our life as well. And then the last thing we can do, going back to, I think, session 3, where we looked at how to meditate using the Shavasana posture, is we can use the Shavasana posture as a transition to sleep. Very often, if we have very busy, hectic lives, then often even at the end of the day, our mind is still agitated, maybe a lot of tension in the body. We try to go to sleep, we're tossing and turning and we can't sleep. So therefore, when you go to bed at night, go into that Shavasana posture, lying flat on your back, and then on every out-breath, release any tension in the body, releasing any thoughts in the mind. And keep doing that on every out-breath, relaxing and releasing, until you start to get a bit drowsy. And when you start to get a bit drowsy, you mentally note, my meditation is now finished, and physically move out of that posture into whatever posture you use for sleep. And so therefore we can use that Shavasana posture not only as a mindfulness shamatha practice at the end of the day, but also to help us to transition to sleep. So that's a few points on how we can set up our day a little bit based on that shamatha practice. So now that brings us to the meditation. And for this meditation, I'd like to do a meditation based on some of the topics we covered in this session, particularly in terms of making our life meaningful and really thinking about our perspective of life and what's important to us and how we can make our life most meaningful. So let's do that practice now. We begin by establishing a good posture, keeping the back nice and straight, and at the same time allow the entire body to become completely relaxed. And relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. And with each out-breath, letting go of any thoughts that may have arisen. And simply allowing the mind to come to rest. Resting in the stillness of the present moment. Now, no matter how much mental afflictions are in our mind, that is, no matter how much craving and attachment, anger and jealousy, fear and anxiety and so forth are in our mind, these mental afflictions are not part of the nature of our mind. They're merely like dirt covering the surface of our mind. And beneath these mental afflictions is the natural purity of our mind. So imagine this inner purity of your mind in the form of a small, white, radiant sphere of light in the center of your chest at the level of your heart. And we can begin to build a vision for this life by reflecting on four points. And the first point is, what are your deepest aspirations in this life? What is your heart's desire? What would you really like to achieve in this life? And try to picture your deepest aspirations very clearly. and then arouse the thought, may I realize my deepest aspirations. And then with each out-breath, imagine rays of light radiating out from the sphere of light at your heart, filling and saturating your entire body and mind. Imagining that your deepest aspirations are being fulfilled right here and now. Now, in order to help you actualize your deepest aspirations, what kinds of material assistance would you like to receive from the world around you? And what kinds of friendship and guidance would you like to receive from the people around you? And then arouse the thought, may I receive everything that I need to actualize my deepest aspirations. And then with each in-breath, imagine reality rising up in the form of white light, streaming in from all directions and providing you with everything you need. Now, the help that we receive from the world around us is not enough for us to actualize the genuine happiness that we seek. For this, inner transformation is essential. So the third point to reflect on is, how would you like to transform and evolve as a person? What faults would you like to be free of? And what qualities would you like to possess? And then arouse the aspiration, may I cultivate the true causes of my own fulfillment. And with each out-breath, imagine rays of white light radiating out from the sphere of light at your heart, filling your body and mind. Imagining that you're becoming that person, free of those faults, possessing those qualities, right here and now. And then finally, for the sake of your own fulfillment and to make your life as meaningful as possible, what would you truly love to offer to the world using your own unique talents? And then with each out-breath, imagine the white light of loving kindness radiating out in all directions from your heart as you actualize this offering to the entire world right here and now. And then release all appearances and allow the mind to come to rest. Resting in this inner purity of your mind. Which is in the nature of loving kindness. And so we can bring the meditation to a close. We have some time for Q&A now. Got any questions for me, Miffy?
Yes, there's a whole lot of questions, Glenn.
Okay, so, let's start.
The first one from Rosemary. So the conditions that you described to support shamatha meditation practice sound quite idealistic because many
Which
people,
conditions? The six prerequisites, you mean?
Or? The ones like because many people are like isolating because of COVID and sharing noisy spaces or being incarcerated or maybe would never have a chance to go on a group retreat. So should we give up on attempting shamatha practice or lower our expectations?
Well, actually, I mean, I think in some ways we can have much better conditions because of COVID, because we're at home more. I mean, particularly if there's a lockdown, then we're not running around doing all these things we normally did, and maybe we're not even going to work and so forth. So actually, for many people, they would have much more time. And then in terms of this idea of Sangha, then of course we've got things like Zoom here. So wonderful opportunity to be at home and to still have Sangha. We can have a virtual Sangha. We can do a group meditation using the Zoom technology. So use modern technology to our advantage. So I think, and that's certainly one thing I'm doing, is now that I'm not running around teaching so much at different places, I have much more time to meditate and so forth.
So then, Glenn, doing a group retreat on Zoom counts as a group retreat still?
Well, it's that, yeah, I mean, that, of course, if we have the possibility to physically be together, that's even better. But, I mean, sometimes because of things like COVID or other reasons, we can't do that, or financial reasons or so forth. And then a halfway house between a physical group retreat and a solitary would be a virtual group retreat. And so I'm leading a number of those now during this time, weekend retreats and so forth.
Okay, thank you. Then Carolyn asks, can you say more about the comment you made about how the physical senses start to reduce and then close down their influence with practice?
Right. So that was in terms of shamatha. So when we're in shamatha practice and we're going to the higher levels, our attention is getting more stable and more clear. It means we're more focused on the object. And of course, we're using our mental consciousness for doing that focus, which means that the sense consciousnesses, the sense faculties, start to shut down and become dormant. And so therefore, actually at the higher levels of practice, if there is some noise around us, we won't hear it. But this is only within shamatha meditation. That doesn't mean our sense faculties, in fact, probably you'll find the opposite happens when you get out of meditation, is that because of your improving of the mental faculty in shamatha practice, you probably find outside of meditation, your senses are more heightened in terms of hearing better, seeing and so forth.
And then Deepa asks, can we progress on the path with subtler states of mind if someone's on medication like antidepressants?
So unfortunately there are, I mean, a lot of people on antidepressants and so forth. And what's not recommended is to say, okay, I'm going to throw out my antidepressants and I'm just going to use mindfulness to treat depression. I think this would not be a very healthy approach. So what we're finding more and more is either doctors or therapists who have starting to have some understanding of mindfulness and Buddhist concepts, and then are giving a regime to people they're helping, where maybe they start by giving them a certain amount of medication, but then over time, relying more and more on other therapies or mindfulness to treat or to help with that, and less on medication. So then you can have an approach where maybe initially you're using a lot of medication, but then under the guidance of a skillful doctor or therapist, reducing that while you're increasing other therapies and mindfulness and so forth. And I've talked to a number of people who've done that, to the point now where they either take no antidepressants or very little.
Okay. And then Andrew asked, is sudden awakening possible, or do we really need to spend years gradually building our meditation skills?
Depends what we mean by sudden awakening. Can we be suddenly enlightened? No. Can we have a sudden, very profound experience that really shifts us dramatically? Absolutely, yes. So that can happen, and that's happened to many people. But what often happens is if that sort of spontaneously happens, and can happen for one of many different reasons, then often what happens is if people don't appreciate what that experience was, they go, oh, that was nice. And it may have some residual effect from days, weeks, or months. But if they don't do anything to follow that up, it'll wear off and it'll go. And then 10 years later, they'll go, oh, I had this really nice experience 10 years ago. Shame about that, it went away. So therefore, if we have these sorts of experiences, and they can happen for one of many reasons, and then we understand what that experience is, then we can use that as a platform to build on using these meditation approaches, a more structured approach to build on that we have as a foundation. So that can be very helpful.
And following on from that, Richard asks, can you comment a little about the details in that picture of the stages of meditation? Right at the top, the two rainbows coming from the student on the elephant and that last point of the path.
Yeah, I'm not seeing any descriptions on that, but it could be, I'm just speculating here, is that, and we see this in Lamrim Chenmo, when he says that when you achieve shamatha, you can take one of two paths of meditation. Either you can do vipassana in terms of emptiness, or you can actually develop higher and higher levels of shamatha in that terms. So maybe that's because I think the elephant's on one of those rainbows and there's another one. So that may depict that, because that diagram is a Tibetan version of it. And definitely if you look in the Lamrim Chenmo and other similar texts, they often talk about once you've achieved shamatha, you can either go off onto the what's called the supramundane path of meditation or the mundane path of meditation. Supramundane is where you're doing vipassana practice of emptiness. The mundane path of meditation is where you're developing higher and higher levels of samadhi, the jhanas and samapati. So perhaps I'm just speculating because I've never seen any instruction on that, but perhaps those two roads is showing those two paths.
And then Delma asks, in terms of a daily practice, and if we have a tantric commitment or something of a meditation, how could we incorporate a short shamatha practice into our existing one, say on Chenrezig, Compassion, Buddha, or?
Yeah, I think you can do it a number of ways. You could, for example, do a shamatha practice before you do your sadhana practice. In that way, hopefully your mind is more calm, more clear, more focused, so that your sadhana practice is more effective. That would be one approach. Another approach would be to integrate the shamatha in the sadhana practice. And in the sadhana practice, there are many points in a sadhana practice where you can insert some shamatha in terms of when you're doing the visualizations and disillusions and so forth. There are a number of points, depending on the sadhana, where you can do some shamatha on a particular object inserted at that point. So I think both of those options would be helpful.
Well, you could do both at the beginning and in the meditation.
Yeah, sure. I mean, again, but remember, quality over quantity. So, we as a beginner, we don't want to do too long. You know, if we're doing 20 minutes of shamatha and then we're normally doing, 30 minutes sadhana, and then we add another 20 there and we have suddenly an hour of practice, maybe we're just going to be daydreaming halfway through.
Okay. Glenn, I had a question right at the beginning when you're talking about the worldview, and sometimes, and you mentioned about how we have this grasping at an independent world, an independent self, and many times in conversation people talk about, let's be objective here. Yeah. So do you have like a life hack of what to think or what to say when that happens?
Let's be objective. I mean, it depends how you understand that word objective. I mean, objective as in an independent objective world, no, that doesn't exist. Objective in terms, I think the correct way to use the word objective is to be objective is to see reality clearly. Because there is a conventional reality, and we can see that accurately, or we can project on top of that. So to see things objectively, to say that in a correct way, within the view of emptiness, would be to not project on top of what's there, because there is a conventional reality there. We're not negating the existence of things. So to see things objectively would be to see things accurately without projecting on top.
Okay, brilliant. And then there's many people saying, how can we do more meditations with you, Glenn? Where can we find more guided meditations or the online retreats? And are you doing another course here at Lungri Tampa Center soon? So I would also like to second that thought and request you, are you able to do another course here at Lungri Tampa Center soon? And
you can find a lot of stuff I do from my website. It's just glennsvenson.org. So I have a lot of materials on there. And also I have a lot of links to audio and video of retreats and courses that I've led. So you can find a lot of stuff on there. I'm starting to put a few things up on, particularly videos up on my YouTube channel. So I'm starting to do that. Also, I'm still waiting, but, you know, I'm using this Insight Timer, and I'm waiting on the Insight Timer, the company, they're changing things now where you can, or the process of putting a course on Insight Timer was not working before, but now they're automating it. So I'm waiting for them to finish that. And then my plan is to put a lot of this stuff that I'm doing, like this and other things, as a course, including guided meditations, on Insight Timer. So that'll be available. I have thrown up a few shamatha meditations on Insight Timer now, so they are available to listen to, but I want to put a lot more stuff up on Insight Timer in terms of running courses like this, including guided meditations and so forth. But I'm waiting for them to update the app where I can put these courses up first. So I'm still waiting on that. I've been waiting on that for some months. And then in terms of me running more stuff for Lungri Tampa, then as I mentioned to you earlier, Miffy, there's a few other things in the pipeline where I have to see how the dust settles on those first before I can commit to anything. But hopefully within a week or two, I'll see what my program looks like for the coming months and then see if we can do something more. And if we do, then I'll probably want to do the next part of the shamatha, that is using the mind and resting in awareness as the objects. That would make sense. But let's see if we can manage to do that.
So I'm pretty sure everybody who's come along to this course would be quite enthused to maybe create the merit by actually getting their shamatha practice going really well, so we can create the perfect conditions for you to come back and lead stage two for us. That would be really wonderful.
Great. Okay. Anything else? Otherwise,
no, that's it.
Okay. So I'll just share the screen again, because I want to do a special dedication here to finish, one that many of you know very well. And so let's dedicate by reading out the dedication prayer from Shantideva. And I think many of you are very familiar with this prayer. So let's end with this prayer, dedicating all of our efforts during this program. May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. Thank you very much. Hope to see you all again sometime soon online. Until then, stay safe, stay well. Bye for now.